So today I continue my sermon series on East Shore Unitarian Church history. And I've touched on mostly, I mean, it's probably unfair, but after all, I'm a minister, so I've touched mostly on the ministers. Somebody said, why don't you do a sermon series on all the presidents? And I'm thinking about it. But we had Lon Ray Call, Chad Springs, Stan Stefanczyk, C. Leon Hopper, and then Peter Luton was called as your fourth settled minister in 1992. Now, between Leon Hopper and Peter was Bob Kaufman, who was an interim minister and kind of an acerbic dude. Acerbic. You know, everywhere he went, he shook things up, which some interims say, well, that's our job, and I guess it is, but you can do that gently, and you can do that. Anyway, Peter was the fourth settled minister. Meanwhile, a deeply loved associate, Joan Montagnus, had been called about halfway through his ministry, too. Now, she left after 8 years, I think, and then Peter left a year later, and then 2 years later, Elaine Parasluha, all abrupt departures. And it was my observation, I'm trying to figure, well, why is the church a little mistrustful of itself, of one another? And it seemed to me that this unexpressed grief around these three rather quick departures. And not much talk about it. Oh, well, yeah, she's gone. She's history. He's gone. Leads to feelings of unexpressed grief, and then that kind of stifles people. And it's hard to trust if you're still got unresolved stuff inside where you felt maybe not betrayed, but left hanging. But there's always some inner turmoil happening in any community. Indeed, Peter pointed out to me that there's a history within this church, a long one actually, of both respect for ministry and distrust of ministry, and that he recognized it when he arrived following Bob Kaufman. Now, if healthy systems are resilient enough within any organization, then ultimately those systems will prevail and the organization will thrive. All ministers work hard to encourage that, and Peter Luton was no exception, working to outlive some of the mistrusts of leadership and doing his part, his honest everyday work of, you know, being a solid guy to help people trust again. Now, there were lingering issues from years before. He told me of the occasion when, like 5 years prior to his arrival, when Dorothy Hopper had to ask the church, the wife of the then minister, had to ask the church secretary to take from her desk the photograph of a former minister, Chuck Reinhardt, please. And in retrospect, many people realized that there was controversy and mistrust all around, that they hadn't really, you don't notice it when you're in the midst of it. It's like if you grow up in a dysfunctional family, you think they're all like that, and then you hang out with your friend Billy, and everybody seems to love each other. What's going on here? So it was a little like that, that once the distrust began to evaporate, people go, oh, so that's so much better. There was a Wednesday potluck group that had come about, apparently, because some members experiencing this distrust started meeting on Wednesday evenings. But Peter just kept plugging away, working to build trust back up. And then at one point, after he'd been at it for a few years, he did a memorial service, and afterwards, Walter Andrews and Ron Hammond pointed out that this distrust thing was kind of ebbing away. Good work, Peter. And the church began to grow, and he felt really good about that. By the late 90s, the congregation sought to sustain and build what Peter referred to as a vertical dimension into the organization. In 92, the congregation was much more, when he arrived, it was more of an Athenian democracy than it is today. That is, the church had to, as a whole, had to answer almost every question. You know, can we sit in a circle like this? Okay, we're going to have a congregational meeting, and we're going to vote on it. All right, just almost everything was of that order. Verticality was increased by adding an administrator who did a lot of supervision and allowing Peter to focus on other things. Now, in a lot of ways, the old governance structure that you guys enjoyed had the minister and the board kind of acting like co-leaders. They were on the same, the minister and nine board members, however many there were at that time, they're equal. Once the church went to policy governance, the minister no longer had to consult the lay leaders anywhere near so much about how to set up the chairs, for instance. Though it's always prudent, I will agree with Peter, to include the board for its wisdom and historical memory. As Laurie noted in Wenda's poem, Peter Luton was a very good preacher. And I've read some of his sermons. It's intimidating in a way. I go, oh, shucks. Look what they're used to. And he clearly enjoyed leading Sunday worship, the gathering of the whole community. It's the heart of the thing. And those who like ministry end up liking it, or they leave it. They leave ministry. And Peter shared with me in particular how much he enjoyed baby and child dedications, the salmon bake, which we're going to have in a couple of weeks, whatever we eat, the bake, which we're going to have in a couple of weeks, and Christmas Eve services, and leading adult education programs, which I like too, though he did less of that after Joan arrived. About halfway through his tenure, that is around the year 2000, Walter Andrews and Millie Malarkey and Janet Garrow were on the Committee on Ministry, and Janet brought the committee's attention to the changing demographics of Bellevue. This is the first time that Peter really began to get aware of the fact that, well, we may be a very white congregation, but Bellevue is changing its ethnic, racial mix. And hello. Now, the committee at that point tried to focus not on what's the minister doing, but what's happening globally that the minister and the church should be attending to. So they kind of flipped things around. And he credited, as I say, Janet and Millie and Walter for that wisdom to say, no, we're not here to cover your butt, Peter, and make your tenure safe. We're here to help you see what you need to be paying attention to, and we need to be paying attention to. And so that really helped the church become more focused socially, and that was part of what led the church to, and Peter, to realize we need to call associate minister who can focus more on social justice and help us attend to that better. He also told me how much he liked working with Bob Keckley, Eric's predecessor, and appreciated how responsible Bob was regarding the changing role of music in the worship life of ESUC. And Bob went to General Assembly and responded to all he had learned there, joined the UU Musicians Network, and I said all those things to Eric, and I told him, you have to do the same, and he is doing the same. So that's good. Now, Peter and his wife, Linda, loved living in Bellevue and raising a family here, the demographics. He'd seen it in his elementary school. He just hadn't thought about it at church because they adopted a Korean child, and with all the Asian children in Bellevue, that child had a lovely experience and felt always at home. And here in the church, the kids all loved this church. They made good friends. They did well. Now, ministers lead. This is one of the things I'm trying to make clear in this sermon series. We lead with both our strengths and our our weaknesses. Now, for Peter, it became clear to him and others that he was not a good administrator. That was not one of his strengths. And in all honesty, I don't think anybody goes to seminary to be an administrator. So it's kind of another skill, which then you realize, whoa, this is really what I need to do more and work on, because this is so much of the energy gets involved in kind of running, being the CEO of this little nonprofit corporation. So anyway, how to deal with that? But for about 10 years, Peter was lucky to have Tom Taggart here as the administrator. And this was a true blessing, and Peter admitted it. He'd been the administrator over at the University of Washington for 25 years, so he could do this job out of his back pocket, and he did. And that relieved Peter greatly. But once he left, things began to slowly unravel. And when things start to slip, the minister can easily find her or himself in trouble. And more than it's that you're in political trouble, it's that you're in emotional trouble. You're in a place of emotional anxiety or fear, you know, because you can feel you don't have the. It's like an athlete, I think, who's losing their eyes or their knees. They know what they have to do, but they can't quite. It's not coming together. So, how isolating in those situations ministry can be. As all of us eventually learn, we can love our members, and we do love them, but they're not really our friends. I hate to put it to you this way. That's part of ministerial discipline. That's the one reason Peter told me that he felt the need to support Joan as much as he did. We could actually talk to one another about ministry and what was going on in our lives, and he went into this long riff on the false intimacy of ministry, which I don't know. But actually, the church did quite well by Peter when it came to supporting his family. Very well. And he told me that he had some guilt about how available he was to all of you because he worked such long hours here at church, but he had none about bringing church home. He never did that. Well, partly because he was always here. So, but the Lutons lived very nearby, and Peter worked a lot at his desk in the administration building, 3 or 4 nights a week, and most Saturdays. That's a lot. This created a huge motivation for him, especially, to get a second minister. And in that environment, there people with ideas were empowered to implement those ideas, and they set the agenda, and there was a lot going on, a lot of programs. The downside to that is that some of those programs weren't that strong, and just keeping track of them was demanding in and of itself. And it was hard to, and then they develop a constituency of their own, and it's hard to say time to quit. So it's an issue. What was Peter's guiding principle? I'm quoting here, the theme of my ministry, spiritual growth and transformation occur within a community of value, of hope, and of faith. My call was to nurture and invoke the spirit of the divine within each person so we can heal, transform, and unite. And I tried to do this within this church by creating a safe, loving, welcoming space where people are invited to get comfortable and then given the tools and cracked open enough so that they can change, none of which is easy. That kind of change involves tremendous amount of compassion for others, extending broadly outward and leading to justice, peace, and more. The challenge, particularly toward the end of my ministry, that I found was the need to minister more and more to the institution than to the members. Even as we added the administrator, my primary relationships grew to become with the staff, which led to even more isolation. I mean, Peter recognized that his tragic flaw was the isolation, that he fell into it. It's counterintuitive. You'd think, well, the minister's such a public role. How could you feel isolated? Because you're the only one doing it this way, and everybody else is doing it this other way. And you're not really, it's not kosher to lean on the members for my needs. I got to find some other place to get those, you know. Carol, my family of origin, my colleagues, but not you guys. Not that if I'm struggling, you know, it's not, it isn't appreciated when it's noted. Shucks, you look tired. Well, yeah, I have been tired. But I can't lean on you. That's the problem with misconduct. It's when you start asking of the other, of the members. You know, you wouldn't ask of your dentist to be intimate in certain ways. It's a little, anyway, it takes time to learn. What I do, what I find whenever I'm, it's just me, whenever I don't know what is going on, whenever it feels like it's slipping, whenever I'm uncertain and I'm confused, I go talk to my members. I call up Walter and Millie and Janet, whoever she was, and say, can I come over? Say, you know, what do you think? Because they'll tell you. They usually know what's going on. And it might be, well, you need to take a weekend off. But it might also be more substantial than that. I noticed that you do this or that, and have you thought about doing this? They'll tell you. Or they'll say, there's an issue with the church that you need attending to and you've been ignoring. So, you can break through the isolation, but you've got to be disciplined. What theological imperative informed Peter's work? He said he came out of the universalist side. I guess I do too. God is love. Got the Stowe, Massachusetts church and the chancel, great big letters. God is love. Without staying, it's that love, without forgetting that, it's that holy energy that informs all our sacred action. Like myself, Peter was strongly influenced by process theology and existentialists. Basically, the notion that don't wait for God to do things. We are the hands of the divine on earth. It's up to us. This is Frederick Douglass. I prayed for 20 years and nothing happened until I gave my prayers legs. Without staying connected to our core values, we avoid the faddism that Unitarians are always prone to. Letting everything go to have it all. That's transformation. I do that benediction from time to time. Remember to let everything go to have it all. Each step at a time reveals the path. These are universal dynamics, and they're what churches are privileged to deal with. According to Peter, and here I completely agree, the church's goal, its purpose, is transformation, both personal and social, changing lives so that we can change the world. Sustaining a compelling and transformational vision, however, is never easy. It's often very difficult, especially for new youth who need to keep finding new metaphors to effectively capture what we're about. And this makes continuity hard. All you youth ministers search for narratives that hold community and its commitments to our shared deepest values as a sacred contract covenant. And we're trying to do that, but, you know, we don't have the Christ crucified metaphor or the Eucharistic metaphor or any of that. So it's a little harder to be hip and contemporary and rooted. If things are moving along well and people feel connected, the mission is so implicit that folks don't get sidetracked. And in that spirit, they did a lot of good work under Peter's leadership, or you did. Now, he said, I was disappointed the way it unwound. It was kind of a slow unwinding. Theologically, Peter's work, as I said, was informed by the universalists. He was an old-time pastor in many ways and a very good preacher. He preached like a Unitarian, but he pastored like a universalist. He was right there and he met you face-to-face. And you could just drop in, and he was likely to be there. It was all like the old universalists. An opportunity to meet one another in the Quaker way. And to recognize moments that make us thankful to be alive. Of course, there was the building expansion, the new lobby, the RE building, and these were exciting because of the ways they enabled this church to expand your service to the community. That was important. Right after 9/11, he pointed out the church was packed, and though not all those people joined, they did a very important thing for time. And it also began our interactions with the Islamic community. Now, the picture on the front is funny, because I asked Peter about his ministry, and then he brought that thing up, and I hadn't even noticed it. But it's out there, right out there. And it used to be, and it, as it usually is for most churches, that 90% of the churches, the closest parking space to the sanctuary says reserved for the minister. Some of them say reserved for the minister 24/7. But they took the sign out when they did some of the construction around here, and nobody even noticed, he pointed out. So he had to contend for his parking space, and so do I. It's not that tough. One of Peter's most, but it personifies him in a way, because he was very modest about it. Yeah, what is he going to make a deal about it? Hey, wait a minute, you took away my park. Not Peter Luther. He was very proud also of starting the covenant circles and how much they increased congregational sense of commitment to one another. Ordination in ministry is a tremendous privilege, but it's also damned hard. And he did not realize how exhausted he was until he retired. He wrote me, "I left my congregation in Yarmouth on the cusp of change before there was a crisis. And I did the same thing at ESUC, admittedly on short notice, in the midst of a crisis, but it was the best I could do." Always, he said, "I always appreciated and wanted a long ministry. I know when a long ministry ends, there's usually a series of challenges for the successor. ESUC is a good community with good people, and they'll figure it out. Transition times are always awkward. I've remained distant out of professional propriety, but I also, because I am done, I am retired. I am free." Here's what I think. Peter Luton was a truly fine minister. I admired him from afar. I admire him even more today. He served here 21 years, and by all rights, he should be your minister emeritus. He left in a huff, which was admittedly bad form, but he was exhausted after many years of toiling in this vineyard as your preacher, confessor, confidant, counselor, and spiritual leader. He was a great preacher, a very good pastor, and a sweet, dependable human being. He was unsurpassed as a storyteller. He'd take his coat off, he'd take his shoes off, and take his socks off in the middle. He'd get everybody totally involved. As Tom Dale put it, during a time when storytelling was very big on public radio, Peter seemed to channel an inner Garrison Keillor. I would feel good if a concluding story told about Peter's ministry here is that he was eventually honored as your minister emeritus, not only for his 21-year tenure, but for his 21 years of fine, wholesome work on your behalf. So may it be.